November 25th, 2012, Sackville, New Brunswick. While attending a house party, 20-year-old university student Chris Metallic becomes intoxicated and leaves to walk back to his residence but never arrives. Nearly 4 hours later, an eyewitness spots Chris walking down a rural road located 15 kilometers away before he disappears into the woods. A search of the area turns up some footprints and a pair of flip-flops Chris had been wearing, but Chris himself is never found, and there is no explanation for how he wound up at this location. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and this week, we're going to be returning to our podcast, Home Country of Canada, to cover a pair of unsolved missing persons cases, the 2012 disappearance of Chris Metallic and the 1992 disappearance of Dean Mortensen. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Darielle Rudnicki, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Darielle. It was 5 years ago this month when I first launched this contest, and when I recently picked Darielle's name and looked back through my original emails, I was surprised to discover that she was officially the very first listener to send an email to enter. So I guess good things do come to those who wait. Anyway, this is still a recurring monthly contest, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. As you probably know, earlier this year, The Trail Went Cold reached a milestone in which we managed to cover at least one cold case from all 50 American states. So I made it a goal to eventually do the same thing for every Canadian province and territory. And we're almost there, as one of the featured cases on this particular episode will be our first mystery from the province of New Brunswick. It involves the disappearance of an Aboriginal university student named Chris Metallic, and since I've received a few requests to cover this one, and we're only a few months away from the 10-year anniversary, I thought now would be a good time to do an episode. Our other featured case is from the province of Alberta and involves another university student named Dean Mortensen. And the one thing these stories have in common is that both these young men disappeared while walking back to their places of residence after a night of drinking. But the key difference is that while Dean Mortensen just seemed to vanish into thin air on campus in the middle of a city, Chris Metallic was last spotted in a rural area located around 15 kilometers outside of town, and there's a lot of question about how he made it that far. Whatever happened, no trace of either of these victims have ever been found, and while it's possible that they both suffered a tragic death via misadventure, there are definitely some odd elements in each of these stories. So I'm going to start off by sharing the details about Chris's disappearance before I move on to Dean's case, and then I'll provide my theories and analysis for both of them. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the unsolved disappearance of Chris Metallic. Our story begins in 2012 in Sackville, New Brunswick, a small town with a population of just over 5,500 people, located in the southeastern section of the province, right next to the Trans-Canada Highway. Our central figure is Chris McKenzie Metallic, a 20-year-old Aboriginal man who hails from the Listigouge Mi'kmaq First Nation, located in Quebec, right next to the New Brunswick border. Chris made the move to Sackville in order to attend Mount Allison University, making him the first member of his family to attend university. He is currently in his third year as an anthropology student and lives in an off-campus house on Maple Avenue, alongside his 18-year-old half-brother, Spencer Isaac, who has begun his first year as a student at Mount Allison. Chris has always been described as a quiet but happy-go-lucky guy who never causes trouble and would often act as the peacekeeper when other students got into disagreements. He also works as a counselor at the youth center in Listigouge during his summer breaks from school. On the evening of Saturday, November the 24th, Chris decided to attend an off-campus house party located at a residence on Allison Avenue, and he invited his younger brother to come along, but Spencer declined. After arriving at the party, Chris consumed a lot of alcohol and passed out, so his friends put him to bed while they went out to visit some of the local bars. When they returned to the house at around 2 a.m. on the morning of November the 25th, they discovered that Chris was no longer in bed, but his glasses, wallet, and cell phone were still on the nightstand, and he also left behind his shoes. It would later turn out that Chris had woken up and joined one of his other friends to head over to another nearby house, but he was so intoxicated that he left without even putting his shoes on. Chris soon started feeling sick and decided he wanted to go home, but to save him the trouble of retrieving his shoes, his friend let him borrow a pair of flip-flops to wear. Sometime between 1:30 and 2 a.m., Chris started walking back towards his residence, but even though the trip should have only taken about 20 minutes, he never arrived. By the evening of November the 25th, Chris's brother Spencer had still not heard from him, so he became concerned enough to contact their mother, Mandy Metallic, in Listigouge. Upon hearing that her son had disappeared, Mandy immediately left to make the 4-hour drive to Sackville. When searches for Chris failed to turn him up, he was officially reported missing the following morning to the Sackville Detachment of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, aka the RCMP. When Chris originally left his residence to attend the party, he was not wearing a proper winter jacket and was clad only in a heavy blue sweater that Spencer had given to him. An extensive search effort was launched by both the RCMP and volunteers from the Tri-County Ground Search and Rescue Group, while university students and faculty members went door-to-door throughout Sackville looking for information. On November the 27th, Mount Allison University held a vigil for Chris, and they also organized a benefit concert called the Concert of Hope for Chris Metallic, in hopes of raising money for a reward fund. There were reports that at around 3 a.m. on November the 25th, just over an hour after he began his walk home, Chris had been seen at Home Alone Pizza, located on Main Street, only 350 meters away from the house where the party had taken place. But as far as I can tell, these sightings were never officially confirmed. However, one sighting which did seem credible took place at 5:30 a.m. that very same morning, when police received a call about a suspicious-looking male matching Chris's description. The call was made by a resident who was driving to work, and noticed this young man walking along Upper Abujigan Road in a rural area outside Sackville, about 15 kilometers away from where Chris was last seen. The resident originally thought that the young man was carrying what appeared to be bolt cutters, but while waiting for the police to show up, he caught another glimpse of him walking by and came to the conclusion that he was likely carrying a pair of driveway markers. By the time police finally arrived, the young man had disappeared into the woods, and a brief search of the area failed to find him. Since Chris had not yet been reported missing at this point, the authorities did not put two and two together. Needless to say, it now seemed very likely that this young man was Chris, so a new search was performed of the area by the police, and they would eventually find a pair of flip-flops at separate locations. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that both flip-flops had been positively identified as the same flip-flops Chris's friend had lent him before he went missing. A set of footprints were found which led to the banks of the Tantramar River, which was frozen over by this point, though no one could be certain if it had already been frozen on the night Chris disappeared. Regardless, an underwater dive team cut and excavated through the ice and performed a search of the river, but they failed to find Chris's body or any evidence that he might have fallen into the water. Even though a number of wooded areas were searched, they failed to turn up any trace of Chris, so on December the 4th, the RCMP announced that they were officially calling off their search effort. However, this did not deter Mandy Metallic, as over the course of the next 2 years, she and other family members and friends would make the 4-hour trek from Quebec to Sackville nearly every other week in order to perform their own searches and post flyers all over the area offering a reward for information. The Metallic family would even use their own money, which they had obtained from fundraisers, in order to rent their own all-terrain vehicles, cadaver dogs, and even a helicopter at one point, but their searches always came up empty. While it was speculated that Chris may have wandered into the woods and succumbed to the elements, that still didn't answer the question of how he wound up in such a remote area to begin with. There was a window of between 3.5 to 4 hours between when Chris was last seen in Sackville and when he was spotted wandering along Upper Abujigan Road by the resident who phoned the police. It seemed questionable that Chris would have been able to walk this 15-kilometer distance in that time frame, but no one ever came forward to report having picked him up or given him a ride that morning. Mandy expressed her frustration with the whole situation by stating, quote, "Not finding him will be the worst thing. I need to bring him home, and then I need to find out what happened," end quote. In May of 2014, Chris would have been scheduled to graduate from Mount Allison University, so in order to pay tribute to him, the other members of the graduating class planted a tree in Chris's honor in front of his former residence on Maple Avenue, at a ceremony which was attended by his family and other residents of the Listigouche Mi'kmaq First Nation. Chris's disappearance had helped lead to the formation of an Aboriginal support group at Mount Allison, and in 2016, the university established the Chris Metallic Prize in Indigenous Leadership, which would be presented annually to a student who exhibited leadership in the indigenization of Mount Allison campus. Following Chris's disappearance, Spencer had a difficult time dealing with the situation, so he wrote a number of letters to him, which always ended with the same request, quote, "Answer back, brother." Over the years, the RCMP has returned to the area where Chris was last seen in order to perform additional searches, but they've been unable to find anything and claim they are no longer receiving new tips in the investigation. After nearly 10 years, there are still no answers about what actually happened to Chris Metallic. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. And now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in Edmonton, Alberta in 1992. Our central figure is 19-year-old Dean Curtis Mortensen, who hails from the small coal mining town of Grand Cache, located over 430 kilometers away. Dean is the eldest of four children in his family, and his father is a foreman at one of the coal mines, but since he excelled at academics, Dean decided to travel to Edmonton to enroll at the University of Alberta as a general science student, and he has just started the second semester of his freshman year. Dean lives on campus at the St. Joseph's College residence alongside over 60 other male students, and he also plays defense for the St. Joe's Rangers, the dorm's intramural hockey team. He is known for being a quiet guy who never causes trouble and does not even swear, and one of Dean's closest friends, Stephen Ballon, would describe him as, quote-unquote, "looking like a character out of a Norman Rockwell painting." On the evening of Thursday, January the 23rd, Dean and a group of friends from his residence went out drinking at a pub called The Ship, located at the Lister Hall residence. Even though Dean was not known for being a heavy drinker, he would consume at least 2 or 3 beers and a couple of shots of vodka at the pub that night, though his friends would say that he did not appear to be visibly intoxicated. At around 12:30 a.m. on January the 24th, Dean decided to leave the pub to walk back to his dorm, and here's where I have to address one of the biggest issues with researching this case, as you'll often come across conflicting information from different sources. I'll discuss this issue in more detail later on, but depending on which source you read, Dean was either accompanied by one or two friends when he left the pub. The walk to the dorm would have taken about 10 minutes, but the story goes that when Dean reached the corners of 87th Avenue and 114th Street, his friend or friends realized that they had forgotten something at the pub and headed back there while Dean waited. They were only gone for a few minutes, but by the time they returned to the spot, Dean was gone. Dean had a class scheduled for 10:30 a.m. that morning, so his friend, Stephen Ballon, who lived on the same floor of his dorm, went to Dean's door and knocked on it. There was no answer, so Stephen initially assumed that Dean was just sleeping in, but concern grew when Dean wound up missing additional classes that day which was very uncharacteristic of him. Stephen finally gained access to the dorm room and discovered that Dean was not there, but since nothing was out of place, and the bed did not appear to have been slept in, it became apparent that Dean never made it back there after leaving the pub. Dean was subsequently reported missing to the Edmonton Police Service, and over the course of the next several days, an extensive search effort was performed of the campus and the surrounding area. Investigators canvassed all the cab drivers in the city who might have been on the university campus on the night Dean disappeared, but they turned up no leads or any trace of Dean at all, so the search was eventually called off. However, 2 weeks after he originally went missing, a hat for the St. Joe Rangers hockey team was discovered, and since Dean had been wearing this hat on the night he vanished, it was believed to have belonged to him. I've seen differing accounts of the hat being discovered in either an alley or the backyard of a residence, but sources state that the location was at 108th Street and Saskatchewan Drive, just over 1 kilometer east of where Dean was last seen. It's also been reported that the hat was found near a chain-link fence, leading to speculation that it might have fallen off Dean's head while he was climbing the fence and he was unable to find it. This location was also not too far from the high-level bridge which overlooked the North Saskatchewan River, but there was nothing to indicate that Dean's body wound up in the water. And even though there were some dense bushes surrounding the river, and searches were conducted of them, they turned up no trace of Dean. Everyone was left completely perplexed by Dean's disappearance, as he did not have any known enemies who might have had a motive to harm him. He showed no signs of being depressed or suicidal, and during his last phone conversation with his mother, Dean had told her that he was very pleased with the marks he received on his winter exams. While Dean had been drinking, and the weather was minus 10 degrees Celsius that night, there was no indication that he wandered off and died of exposure. It also seemed unlikely that Dean ran away on his own accord, as he withdrew $20 from his bank account prior to his trip to the pub, but he left over $3,000 untouched. A photo of Dean would be hung in the study hall at St. Joseph's College as a memorial to him, as well as a St. Joe's Rangers hockey jersey featuring his number 55 on the back, which has since been retired in his honor. Every year on the anniversary of Dean's disappearance, it has become tradition for residents of the college to hang St. Joe's Rangers jerseys outside their windows in tribute to Dean and hold a vigil for him. The University of Alberta also awards an annual Dean Mortensen Scholarship every year to a student who is active in intramurals, has leadership skills, and contributes to a safer campus. However, after the initial search effort for Dean, the investigation would fail to turn up any leads which shed any light on what happened to him, and there have not been any further developments. So after 30 years, Dean Mortensen continues to remain a missing person. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Hi there, I would just like to take a few moments to give a shout-out to another podcast titled Wrongful Conviction. Hosted by celebrated criminal justice reform advocate and founding board member of the Innocence Project, Jason Flom, and by Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast host and producer, Maggie Freeling, Wrongful Conviction features intimate conversations with men and women who have spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit. Each episode peels back the layers to tell the stories of those who have found themselves caught in a legal system gone wrong. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling airs each Monday, and Jason Flom's episodes air on Thursdays. Please search, find, and follow Wrongful Conviction wherever you listen to podcasts. So what we have here are two similar cases in which young male university students vanished while walking back to their place of residence after a night of drinking, though there are some notable differences between them. In Chris Metallic's case, it seems indisputable that he was heavily intoxicated, and this would explain a number of his actions, such as his decision to walk home on a cold November night in flip-flops while leaving his wallet, glasses, and cell phone behind at a party. In Dean Mortensen's case, the people he spent the evening with did acknowledge that he had been drinking, but they did not believe he was overly intoxicated, particularly since he was scheduled to go to class the following morning. Another key difference between the two cases is that we have a reported sighting of Chris at another location hours after he left the party, but Dean just seemed to vanish into thin air within a very narrow window of time. And of course, we also have to address the fact that Chris was Aboriginal. It's no big secret that Canada has always had an epidemic of violence involving missing and murdered Indigenous women and controversy about the lack of attention these cases receive, but its issues involving missing and murdered Indigenous men should not be ignored either. But surprisingly, it seems like Chris Metallic's case has wound up getting more mainstream media coverage than Dean Mortensen's, as Chris's disappearance got a decent amount of coverage from the country's biggest media outlet, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, aka CBC. However, it seems like the media coverage of Dean Mortensen's disappearance has mostly been limited to the Edmonton area, and I probably wouldn't have heard of this case had it not been featured in a special edition of Maclean's magazine titled Canada's Greatest Unsolved Mysteries, which came out in 2013. Dean is definitely still remembered at the University of Alberta, as they still commemorate the anniversary of his disappearance every year by holding vigils and hanging jerseys for the St. Joe's Rangers hockey team outside the windows of his former dorm in tribute. However, it appears that his story is mostly unknown throughout the rest of Canada, and while it's easy to come up with a pretty logical scenario for what happened to Chris, it seems like no one has the slightest idea about what might have happened to Dean. And like I mentioned earlier, Dean's case is also hampered by the issue of contradictory information from different sources, which I'll be addressing as we go along. But first, we'll start off by exploring the circumstances of how Chris went missing. I've already mentioned that Chris was Aboriginal, and I'll explore that angle in more detail later on. However, it's also worth mentioning that in February of 2015, the CBC radio show, Sunday Edition, produced an episode about this case titled, Answer Back Brother, which of course, is the last sentence that Chris's half-brother Spencer always wrote on letters that were addressed to him following his disappearance. When Spencer was interviewed on the show, he mentioned that Chris was gay, and I get the impression that not many people knew this, as Chris may have still been struggling with his sexuality and was not particularly open about it. Spencer stated, quote, "Emotionally, you know, he had a lot of stuff buried deep down within him. He wasn't comfortable expressing who he was. I feel like that really dragged him down. He wasn't at that point in his life yet to really just say who he was. I feel like if he did that, you know, things would be different. He could still be here." End quote. Of course, there's nothing to suggest that Chris's sexuality had anything to do with his disappearance, but it's implied that this might have played a role in Chris's decision to drink so heavily on the night he went missing. Spencer has always been very open about the fact that his brother's disappearance caused him to fall into a deep depression, and he wound up failing his first year at university. Since Chris had invited Spencer to the party that night, and Spencer declined, I'm sure that must weigh heavily on him, though there's no way you could believe that Spencer was in any way at fault. I have covered a couple of cases on this podcast where an individual got intoxicated at a party before they went missing or wound up dead, and there were implications that some sort of cover-up took place. But that doesn't appear to be the case here, as it seems pretty cut and dry that Chris left on his own accord and was still alive when he was seen at another location hours later. We know that he started heading back to his residence sometime between 1:30 and 2 a.m., and even though the walk should have only taken around 20 minutes, he somehow wound up 15 kilometers away on Upper Rabugigan Road at 5:30 a.m. And this is where the big mystery of this story comes into play. Chris left his wallet, cell phone, glasses, and shoes behind at the party, and even though it was a cold November morning, he did not have a winter coat, and was instead dressed in a sweater and a pair of flip-flops. Under those circumstances, would Chris really have been capable of making that entire 15-kilometer trek in under 4 hours? We have an eyewitness who reported seeing a young man matching Chris's description walking along Upper Rabugigan Road at 5:30, and since the flip-flops he was wearing were found in the area, this does confirm that the sighting was legitimate. The witness also claimed that they initially believed that Chris had bolt cutters in his hand, which would be pretty bizarre, but then came to believe that he was probably holding driveway markers. Chris may have stolen these markers from a residence he passed by, which sounds like the sort of thing a drunk person would do if they are not in the most rational state of mind. Since Chris was last seen disappearing into a wooded area, the most logical explanation is that he died of exposure and his remains have not been found. I've seen so many missing persons cases where a massive search effort is conducted for the victim in a wilderness area and they fail to find anything, only for someone to stumble across the remains years after the fact. So even though multiple searches have been performed of the area this past decade and turned up empty, that doesn't necessarily mean that Chris is not there. I know that footprints were found heading in the direction of the Tantramar River, and a search of the water failed to turn up his body, but while the river itself is fairly small, it does flow into the Bay of Fundy, which eventually leads into the Atlantic Ocean. So if Chris's body was carried that far before the dive team searched the river, it might be unrecoverable. By that point, the ice was so thick that the divers had to use chainsaws and an excavator to get through it, but it's unknown if the ice was there on the morning Chris disappeared, or was at least thin enough that it could have broken if Chris walked onto it. However, even if Chris succumbed to the elements and drowned, that doesn't explain how he could have made it to this area to begin with. In online discussions about this case, I've actually seen suspicion directed towards the resident who called in the sighting of Chris to the police, as we technically do not have any other independent eyewitnesses who can corroborate his story about Chris being there that morning, and he was gone by the time police arrived. But I've also seen no indication that the resident has ever been considered a possible suspect, and I'd like to think he was thoroughly investigated by police. If he was involved in Chris's disappearance, why would he even contact the police and share this story to begin with? Otherwise, no one would have any reason to believe that Chris was even in that area. So let's try to figure out the route Chris would have taken if he traveled from Allison Avenue in Sackville to Upper Aboojigan Road 15 kilometers away. According to Google Maps, it would take just over 3 hours to walk that distance, and since there's a gap of between 3.5 to 4 hours between when Chris started his walk and was seen on Upper Aboojigan Road, it's certainly not impossible. But there are many different things you have to factor into play. One issue is that the early reporting stated that Chris was seen at Home Alone Pizza at around 3 a.m. that morning, which was located in Sackville, about 350 meters away from the house where the party took place. To be fair, this sighting was described as being quote-unquote unconfirmed, so it's not entirely clear to me if this sighting is legitimate and if Chris actually went to the pizza place at that time. But if he was there at 3 a.m., then it seems very unlikely that he would have been able to make that 15-kilometer walk in 2.5 hours. And putting that aside, you also have to factor in that Chris's route from Allison Avenue to his residence on Maple Avenue required him to travel west, whereas Upper Aboojigan Road is located directly north and would probably involve Chris walking on the Sackville Waterfowl Park Trail. No matter how intoxicated he might have been, would Chris have really gotten that lost and managed to travel that far out of town? So this opens up the question about whether Chris climbed into a vehicle at any point and was driven to this remote location. Of course, no one has ever come forward to admit giving Chris a ride, and the obvious issue with this theory is that the eyewitness on Upper Aboojigan Road saw Chris walking around alone. So why would someone pick him up and then just drop him off in the middle of nowhere? Well, there's a potentially sinister explanation for this. If you go all the way back and listen to episode number 5 of The Trail Went Cold, about the disappearances of Terrence Williams and Felipe Santos, you'll hear me make reference to a practice known as a starlight tour. It involves the police picking up intoxicated individuals and taking them into custody, but instead of formally arresting or charging them, they drive the victims out into the middle of nowhere and abandon them, and they are forced to find their own way back home. Sadly, many of the victims who were subjected to starlight tours were indigenous men, and the practice wound up achieving notoriety in Saskatchewan when members of the Saskatoon Police Service caused the deaths of multiple indigenous men by driving them outside the city and abandoning them in remote areas in freezing temperatures where they wound up succumbing to hypothermia. Since Chris was a young indigenous male who was walking alone while intoxicated on a cold night, could he have been picked up and subject to a starlight tour? Now, keep in mind that this is all just speculation on my part, as there is no evidence at all to support this theory. And I'm also not going to accuse the Sackville RCMP of engaging in this practice, because an alternate explanation is that a random civilian could have offered Chris a ride, but then took him by complete surprise by driving him out into the middle of nowhere and abandoning him. Again, there's no evidence that this happened, but it would definitely explain how Chris wound up on Upper Aboojigan Road without having to make a 15-kilometer trek there on his own. It would also account for why no one has ever admitted to giving Chris a ride, especially after his disappearance started receiving coverage in the media. Much like the Saskatoon Police Service when they delivered their Starlight tours, this person may not have directly harmed Chris, but they played a role in causing him to succumb to the elements when they abandoned him in the middle of nowhere. If this is what happened, then it's a tragedy that Chris disappeared into the woods after the police were called, and they were unable to give him the assistance he needed. So if Chris actually died of exposure or drowned in the river, then this might be one of those missing persons cases where the big mystery is not what ultimately happened to the victim, but how they got from point A to point B. However, perhaps all my theorizing about a Starlight tour or an unknown motorist giving Chris a ride is completely wrong, and he did manage to travel that entire distance on his own. People are capable of doing unusual things when they are drunk. The fact of the matter is that until Chris's remains are found, we will never know for sure what happened to him. Mandy Metallic and the rest of Chris's family have been amazing advocates for him, as they have spent a great deal of time and resources in order to travel to the Sackville area and perform their own searches for him. While they haven't found him, I have seen a number of missing persons cases where a victim's remains are suddenly discovered years after the fact in the same area where they disappeared, so for all we know, the same thing may happen with Chris at some point. But if there is another party out there who knows what happened to Chris, the 10th anniversary of his disappearance is right around the corner, so here's hoping that this might lead to some additional media coverage and possibly increase the chances of the right person coming forward with information. So before I provide the necessary law enforcement contact info for Chris's case, I want to continue discussing the disappearance of Dean Mortensen, which is a major puzzler. While Chris was last spotted in a remote area heading into the woods, Dean seemed to vanish on a university campus in the middle of a big city, so the odds of him wandering off and dying of exposure without anyone recovering his body are far less likely. This literally seems to be a missing persons case where the victim was there one moment and gone the next, so there's virtually nothing to work with. I mentioned earlier that I first became familiar with this case when it was featured in a special 2013 edition of Maclean's magazine titled Canada's Greatest Unsolved Mysteries, but some of the information shared in that article contradicts the earliest reporting of Dean's case, most of which was done by the Edmonton Journal. Of course, the most frustrating part is the conflicting info about how many people were present with Dean at the time he went missing, as the earliest articles state that he had been walking back to the St. Joseph's College dorm with one of his friends until this friend realized he had forgotten something at the pub. However, the Maclean's magazine article says that Dean was accompanied by two friends who both went back to the pub together, and by the time they returned to the spot where Dean was supposed to be waiting, he had disappeared. In the end, it may not even matter if Dean was with one or two friends that night, but since they were technically the last people to see Dean alive, it would be useful to know if there is more than one person to corroborate this story. In online discussions about this case, I have seen suspicion directed towards the friend or friends, as Dean was reportedly in very close proximity to the dorm when they turned back to go to the pub, as the resident's back door was less than 100 meters from this spot, and once he went there, all he would have needed to do was walk straight up the back steps and make it to his room. Given that it was a cold night with a temperature of minus 10 degrees Celsius, why would Dean just stand there waiting instead of accompanying his friend or friends to the pub or simply heading back to his dorm? But to be fair, this might explain why the friends were not initially concerned when Dean disappeared, as they probably just figured that he returned to his room to get out of the cold, and it was only after he missed multiple classes later that day when he was officially reported missing to the police. However, there are also conflicting details with this part of the story, as a 2007 article from the University of Alberta Alumni Magazine states that Dean's friend, Stephen Belland, forced his dorm room open at around 1 p.m., while the Maclean's magazine article states that Stephen convinced the dorm's prefect to let him inside Dean's room after he missed supper that night. Either way, the condition of the room seemed to indicate that Dean never made it back there after he left the pub. There's very little information out there about the friend or friends who were supposedly with Dean when he vanished, but I'd like to think that the police did their due diligence when investigating their story and had no reason to believe they were being untruthful or knew more about the disappearance than they were letting on. So assuming that their account is completely accurate, Dean somehow managed to vanish without a trace within a span of only a few minutes. The only clue which ever turned up was Dean's St. Joe's Ranger hat, but once again, we have conflicting details from different sources about whether it was found in an alley or the backyard of a residence. Whatever the case, it does seem like the information about the location where the hat was found is consistent, as it's been reported as being near 108th Street and Saskatchewan Drive. That's a pretty important detail, because if Dean lost his hat there and continued traveling north, he would have made it to the North Saskatchewan River. And of course, if he somehow wound up in the water, that might explain why his body has never been found. However, it would have taken around 25 to 30 minutes for Dean to walk to the river from the location where he was last seen, and his hat was found over a kilometer to the east. One thing I've always wondered is how investigators could be so certain that the hat belonged to Dean to begin with. You can actually find a photograph of the hat online, but there's nothing really distinctive about it to indicate that it was Dean's, and given that the St. Joe's Rangers were the campus's intramural hockey team, I'm sure there were a number of hats like this in existence at that time. So it's possible that the hat is a red herring and never belonged to Dean, or it originally fell off his head at another location and the wind blew it to the spot where it was found. But given that there are no other clues in this case, I can understand why the hat would be given so much significance. In a 1993 Edmonton Journal article, Murray Scott, the lead detective on the case, pushed forward a theory that Dean decided to go for a walk to clear his head after spending the night at the pub, and that his hat might have fallen off while he was climbing a chain-link fence located next to the spot where it was found. But again, this was over a kilometer away, so how much of a walk would Dean have required? It's been reported that Dean drank two or three beers and a couple of shots of vodka at the pub that night, and since he wasn't known for being much of a drinker, I could see how that might have caused him to become intoxicated. But he was also at the pub for a total of 5 hours, and had a 6'1", 165-pound frame, so if he spread his drinking out over a long period of time, I'm sure he wouldn't have gotten that drunk. He also had a class scheduled for 10:30 a.m. the next morning, and given his reputation for being a responsible guy, Dean likely wanted to keep his head clear, and making the random decision to take a 1 kilometer walk off campus on a cold night does seem out of character for him. In that same Edmonton Journal article, Detective Scott expressed his belief that if Dean did not fall into the North Saskatchewan River, he might have wandered into the dense bush located in the river valley and died of exposure, though searches of the area turned up nothing. Scott also brought up the valid point that since Dean was a decent-sized hockey player who knew how to defend himself, he would not seem like a candidate to be the target of a random violent crime, and it does not sound like he had any known enemies. Even if someone might have been inclined to attack Dean for the purpose of robbing him, why would they go to the trouble of moving his body? All that being said, I do find it unusual that in many of the articles I've seen about this case, the police have stated that they do not believe foul play was involved. Perhaps the oddest statement was made in the August 4, 1992 edition of the Edmonton Journal by Staff Sergeant Steve Koenig of the Edmonton Police Service's Criminal Investigation Section. He seems to contradict himself in the same article, as he initially states, quote, "From what we can see, this kid had it all. There was no reason for him to want to commit suicide and no reason for anyone to abduct," end quote. But then later on, Kenny goes on to express his belief that Dean took his own life by jumping into the river, stating, quote, "I think something snapped at him, whether it was caused by the alcohol, pressure from school, or whatever, and he, just being half drunk, decided that life ain't worth living and took a walk," end quote. Okay, so was Dean suicidal or not? It's never been reported that Dean showed any signs of being depressed or suicidal, but could Koenig have known something about Dean's mental state when he made that statement? Or was the Edmonton Police Service presenting this hypothetical scenario about Dean jumping into the river in order to account for their inability to find his body? One of the biggest issues I have with the suicide theory is that if Dean's friends are telling the truth, then his decision to take his own life came about after an event he could not have anticipated. Remember, Dean went missing after his friends realized that they had forgotten something at the pub and headed back there. If Dean was feeling suicidal, what was his plan if his friends had not parted ways with him? After they left, did he just feel this sudden compulsion to make a 30-minute walk to the North Saskatchewan River and kill himself? I know that suicidal people sometimes do very unpredictable things, but this doesn't seem to add up. If Dean did not take his own life or wander off and succumb to the elements, the only other explanation which makes sense is if he left the area in a vehicle. Given how close he was to his residence, It makes no sense for him to accept a ride from anyone, meaning that he could have been coerced into climbing into a vehicle or abducted by force. But who would have had the motive to harm him? What are the odds that Dean would cross paths with this person during this very narrow window of time when he was alone? In the end, none of the scenarios in this case make much sense at all, and this really does come across as one of those puzzling missing persons cases where the victim just seemed to vanish into thin air. It's also quite frustrating that Dean's case has not gotten much attention in the media these past 3 decades, other than that aforementioned article in McLean's magazine, and I have no idea if his disappearance is still being actively investigated, or if there's been any progress at figuring out what happened to him. However, even though Dean's story is not that well known across Canada, he has definitely not been forgotten at the University of Alberta, who have gone out of their way to memorialize him and continue the annual yearly tradition of hanging St. Joe's Rangers hockey jerseys outside the dorm windows in tribute. The disappearances of Dean Mortensen and Chris Metallic are both very sad and frustrating, but until these victims are found, all we can do is keep their memories alive and continue spreading word about the cases in hopes of a resolution someday. So if you happen to have any information on the disappearance of Chris Metallic, please contact the Sackville Detachment of the RCMP at 506-364-5023. That's 506-364-5023. And if you happen to have information on the disappearance of Dean Mortensen, please contact the Edmonton Police Service at 780-423-4567. That's 780-423-4567. In both these cases, you can also make an anonymous phone call to the Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. Anyway, another special thanks to listener Darielle Radnicki for narrating the opening of this week's episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see featured on this podcast. Once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the 1970 murder of 18-year-old Joanne Weigel and the subsequent disappearance of her 18-year-old high school sweetheart, Mike Klein, who became a wanted fugitive before he could be arrested for the crime and has not been seen for over 50 years. In addition, I dropped an exclusive bonus episode for my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my 2 co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1988 murder of Philip Fraser. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Holly E., Dominga T., and Arlene H. Thank you all so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, The Golden Age of Murder.
1960s to the early 1990s, the United States saw an unprecedented surge in serial killing, rooted not just in dynamic changes of the post-war period, but in the development of the human psyche going back many millennia to our ancient past. Wonder why serial killers exist? Why they emerged? And why they exploded in the post-war United States? Check out The Golden Age of Murder, a panoramic look at serial killing focusing on the United States in the post-war period. A podcast that goes beyond serial killer profiles to dig into why serial killers exist and to find out why the 1960s to 1990s is the apogee of serial murder. This is The Golden Age of Serial Murder with your hosts, Toby and Simi.
I also wanted to mention that later this month, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes. In fact, At 9:15 a.m. on the morning of August the 28th, I'll be participating in a panel session with another podcast called Shockingly Wicked, in which we discuss unsolved mysteries. I'll even be screening a copy of my little scene video titled The Unsolved Mysteries Fanatic, which was made about 3 years before we launched The Trail Went Cold, and was our early attempt to turn this concept into a YouTube series before we ultimately turned it into a podcast. It features me doing my best Robert Stack impression, and not a lot of people have seen this video, but if you attend my session at the True Crime Podcast Festival, you'll get an exclusive screening. So in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.